The atmospheres of stars inform us about the atmospheres of planets. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Western Worlds. I'm John Kissy, and I'm coming to you, as always, from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at the University of Western Ontario, London, Canada. What mysteries lie within exosolar systems and the hearts of their stellar centres? In the search for new worlds and the attempt to classify them, planetary scientists have uncovered interesting correlations between planets and stars, namely that the atmospheres of brown dwarf stars can be used in the characterization of exoplanet atmospheres. This week we talk to Yifan Shao, graduate researcher at the University of Arizona, to discuss his most recent research on brown dwarf stellar atmospheres and exoplanets. So without any further delay, let's have a listen. Okay, Yifan, thanks for taking the time to speak to us. We're very grateful here at Western Worlds. Now, your area of research is in the observation of extrasolar planets and brown dwarfs, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
We're going to get into that like a little bit deeper in a bit, but let's start at the beginning. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and your education and how you ended up in your research area?
Okay, I took my education before grad school. All my education are in China. We have to take an entrance exam to go to college in China. And in that period of time, all my choice I've made is to study physics in undergrad. So I went to Peking University, which has a top physics program in China. And there in my second year of college, I started to looking for opportunities for research, and I also have a plan to go to North America for grad school at that time. And so I choose the best option for me is to go to a Kavli Institute for Astronomy in Peking University, because it's a very international institute, so that I can get a sense of how people from different country work, and they have a top-notch astronomy research going on there. So I found my undergrad research advisor, who is actually American. His name is Gregory Herzog. So I worked with him on basically using Hubble Space Telescope to measure the formation and formation rate of some planetary mass companion. That project really inspired my interest in studying extrasolar planets. So that's how I decided to devote a career in astronomy study.
And as a young man, you already had an idea that you wanted to go to North America. Why was that?
I think primarily I really want to be a scientist. Mm-hmm. That's from a very young age. I do not really have a rational idea for that. Mm-hmm. That's one part. Another part is I know from a relatively young age, high school, I want to go to the part of the world that has the top research opportunities, which I think is the choice is North America. Mm. So
you started, you did your undergrad with your supervisor. Mm-hmm. What happened then?
So I applied to graduate school, and I also took a summer research internship when I was in my third year of undergrad in University of Michigan. Mm-hmm. That's also a very, very good experience for me. I got a sense of what's the difference, for example, of the research atmosphere of American school and a Chinese school. It's more open American, mm-hmm. and I think it fits me better, and inspired me once more to apply to graduate school. So I applied and got admitted to a few schools, and I decided to go to Arizona. Hmm.
So there's lots of interesting questions that come to mind. The one that I'm really interested in at the moment is, what's the difference? What's the difference between going to school in China and going to school here in Canada?
It's a really big question, actually.
Yeah.
So I think the form of education, one thing I think I can comment on is like the form of education and the focus of education is, I think, is relatively very different.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think in China, like it's almost like engineer oriented education. So they trained us really hard to do math. For example, to have like an engineer type of thinking, and then not, I think like the creativity thinking is not very promoted.
Mm.
Okay. So here, because I interacted with a few like undergrads when I was doing TA, I sense that their like mathematical skills compared to Chinese students are like Chinese students has way better mathematical skills, but they are. So the students here in North America, they're much more creative,
okay. And
they're much more interested in science itself instead of like using math to solve some like a science questions in the book. So they are interested in the scientific event, for example, scientific discoveries, scientific news. I think because in China, we don't really have like a science class. We only have like a math class, physics class, which teach like physics laws, like was discovered 100 years ago. But here, I think there are actual science class, which is follow the like the cutting edge science discoveries. I think that's the difference.
So what led you to go to there? You said you were inspired after working at Michigan, then you
applied to American graduate school. But I think the difference is not too much difference. I just go through their application stuff because there are a lot of Chinese students has done this, and I just follow there what they did to apply to grad school and got admitted.
And did you apply based on the subject you're working on now, or was that something that came to you after you got in?
I think when I applied, I just looking for graduate pro. I didn't really know like the exact science topic I will work on for graduate school. I just look for the grad program that are big, and I think that's how I choose what program I apply.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about your research topic now. Like, what exactly is it practically that you're doing in terms of, like, maybe you can explain what it is first and then explain like how the kind of things that you have to think about when you're trying to achieve your goal.
So the primary research topic I work on today is to use Hubble Space Telescope primarily to study the clouds formation in the atmosphere of brown dwarfs.
Okay.
And we have a very developed and a very powerful technique called time-resolved spectroscopy observation. So basically, we use Hubble Space Telescope to stare at a brown dwarf for a couple of hours. And with the rotation of the brown dwarf, we will see the cloud structure on the surface that is face us to us. Because of its rotation, we will see the cloud structure changes. We are trying to catch the like a spectroscopic variability introduced by this rotation of the brown dwarf to figure out what's the cloud structure of the brown dwarf.
Are you saying that, because I thought brown dwarfs were stars?
Brown dwarfs are sort of like stars, sort of like a planet.
They sit in the middle ground between the gas giants and the actual stars, right?
Right. They are, they're just too small to have hydrogen burn in their atmosphere, because you need to be big enough to trigger hydrogen burning in the atmosphere so that it can be called a star. But the brown dwarf, instead, they're like much less massive than normal stars, so
right. They
don't have hydrogen burning.
So there are clouds, like there are clouds on Jupiter in the brown dwarfs, right?
There are clouds, but so the difference is the composition of the clouds are different.
Okay.
So in Jupiter, I think normally we have like ammonia clouds in the Jupiter's atmosphere, but in brown dwarfs, they are much much hotter than Jupiter.
Right.
They're like I think 2,000 Kelvin as hot as that. Mm. So because of that, like iron can be in liquid form.
Right, okay.
So they can have like iron clouds or like a silicate clouds in their atmosphere.
Right, okay. So yeah. So your research is using Hubble to sort of categorize these various brown dwarfs and quantify the composition of their upper atmospheres.
Exactly.
Okay. So like what's the process of doing that? How do you extract from that data the composition of the atmosphere of a brown dwarf?
So first of all, you need to, for Hubble, it's a very competitive instrument. Everyone wants to use it because still, even though it's like 26 years old, it's still like the top instrument in the world. So we need to figure out like a very good science case for it to write a proposal to space telescope to acquire time. And if they think, okay, to understand the atom clouds in the atmosphere of brown dwarf is important enough, they will give us time so that they will control Hubble to take the images and send it to us. So basically compared to normal like astronomers, we don't really do observation by ourselves. We just use the telescope's data.
Mm-hmm.
After we get the data, so that's I think that's a boring part of the astronomer's life. We need to like sit down and do the programming, and basically we have normally for one target we have like hundreds of images, and the hundreds of images we build like sophisticated softwares to extract the spectroscopic informations from each of the images. So and then we align the images align the spectral that extracted from the hundreds of images,
mm-hmm.
With time, so that we see with time how's the some of the spectral features changes with time with the rotation of the object,
mm-hmm.
and then we compare the results with some models that build for this brown dwarf atmosphere to tell us what exactly going on in the atmosphere of this object.
So what have you learned from that process so far? Is there anything new?
You mean in terms of like a scientific discovery?
Yeah, exactly. Well, not even necessarily discovery, just even if it's just for you personally. Like,
I think that's quite a lot. At the beginning of my grad school, I don't even know like why clouds are important.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I found like using Hubble is cool. And to study the atmosphere of a brown dwarf is very interesting. Yeah. But why clouds?
That's a good question. Why are clouds important? Why don't you tell us why is this?
So I think we can take a look back at the Earth's atmosphere. If we want to understand the Earth's atmosphere, if we are aliens, we need to choose a relatively sunny days.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's cloudy, we can't see very deep into mm-hmm. the atmosphere. So that's a problem for a lot of extrasolar planets. For some like a spectrum that we get for extrasolar planets, we know they're cloudy. And we know clouds are a very important opacity source in their atmospheres. So in order to extract exact composition for the extrasolar planets, we need to understand the contribution from clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And so the other part is why we use brown dwarf. Because extrasolar planets, they're very hard to observe. Their observations are very expensive. So one of the most precise extrasolar planets, spectrum cost 60 Hubble telescope orbits. Mm-hmm. That's like nearly 100 hours of Hubble time. And if you convert it to how much spending, like a funding to Hubble, that's millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But brown dwarf, instead, they emit a lot of light, and they don't have a bright star that is close to them so that we can see them much easily. And their atmosphere, because of their temperature, resembles the temperature of extrasolar planets. So we can use the brown dwarf as a proxy to compare to the model that we built for extrasolar planets and to make those models better. That's the reason we use the brown dwarf to study the clouds.
So maybe we can talk a little bit about extrasolar planets now.
Yeah.
So What are the difficulties in viewing extrasolar planets with the Hubble telescope?
Okay, so I think there are a few methods that we can use to... So first of all, we need to discover them. That's basically... there are a few methods. The most successful method is called transit.
Mm-hmm.
So the transit basically is a planet goes in front of the star and we see a dip in the star's light curve. And using Hubble, we can go one step further. We can compare the depths of the dip for different wavelengths. And Hubble is, because Hubble is in the space, we don't have the interference from the Earth's atmosphere. So that we can specifically, we can looking for the water absorption feature in the spectrum for extrasolar planets. So the problem is, so the dip is itself is very small. It's normally for the largest planets, it's about 1% of the dip.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to looking for the difference of the dip in different wavelengths. That's the amplitude normally we use ppm to measure it, which is parts per million.
Mm-hmm.
So you can consider it's, we need very, very precise measurement. And Hubble's, I think it's capable of doing this kind of measurement for some planets, but not ideal enough so that we are looking at the James Webb.
Mm-hmm.
Hubble, I think still Hubble is very, very powerful. I think it's beyond our expectation.
Mm. So, what kind of planets are you looking at? Are they gas giant planets, or are you able to resolve rocky planets?
So for my research specifically, except for brown dwarf, I also look at like a very giant planet that we can directly see the planet itself with Hubble image. So if the planet emit light, it's like hot enough. There is a possibility if it's really far away from the star, like 60 or 80 AU away from the star, we can see the planet. That's giant, like a four to five Jupiter mass.
Right. Okay.
That's giant. And I also did some work on using the transit method to study planets. For those methods, we can look at. I looked at a few very small planets. In fact, I worked with like a students back in Arizona. We look at the Hubble spectrum of TRAPPIST-1 planets.
Mm-hmm.
Those planets are just a little bit bigger than the Earth, so that's just a normal small planets.
So that must be very exciting.
Yeah, that's very exciting. But the exciting part is we can take spectrum for those small planets. I think the other part of that is making us really, really want to use James Webb is for some of those planets, like the small planets, I think the instrument for now are not sensitive enough to really see the spectral features on it. And I think James Webb would definitely help in like to see the spectral features on those planets.
Okay, well, it's been very interesting talking to you. Thanks very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh.
So I've got one last question, which is if anybody's listening to this and they're inspired like you were and they're interested in sort of going down this this path, do you have any sort of tips or any suggestions for somebody who's interested in going into your area as to what they need to do to get there?
Oh, I think there are a few things I think maybe I want to mention. If they want to go to graduate school, to have a really strong background in physics, math, and programming, I think is really important.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is to just to get yourself like inspired. It's just to read like science news frequently, because there are a lot of interesting science news about extrasolar planets going on like every day. I think is one of the most exciting aspect of science in today's science. I think extrasolar planet science is the learning curve is very shallow, and there are some like ways you can get involved directly. There are like online, I think there is a website you can take a look at the real Kepler light curve of taken with Kepler Space Telescope. We can looking for the dips, like we discussed before, the transit dips. You can see it directly on the website. And there is a possibility some of the transit signal were not catched by scientists before.
Ooh.
So they're dumping all these light curves to everyone so everyone can look at it and using like the power of number to get everyone involved and looking for those signals.
So there's a way that people can get involved
directly
right yeah. now and be involved in discoveries. That's very interesting as well.
Yeah, I think just one month ago, I saw a paper saying basically just I think that's a paper a few so-called citizen scientists, basically it's amateur, I think, astronomers.
Mm-hmm.
They found a few extrasolar planets that was not discovered by scientists. And that's pretty exciting.
And now for the roundtable discussion.
So, guys, Yifren Shao, what did you think about the interview with Yifren?
I really enjoyed learning about brown dwarfs.
It was quite interesting, was it? What was it about brown dwarfs that you found particularly interesting?
I love brown dwarfs from, you know, when I first heard about them in my undergrad. When one of the professors was like, hey, brown dwarfs are interesting because if Jupiter was a little bit bigger than what it is right now, it would be a brown dwarf. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
So, you know, they form this really thin line between planets and stars. And it's very interesting to know how they're very similar to planets, but they're also very similar to stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I like hearing how they study brown dwarfs to be able to learn more about the extrasolar planets because we can see them better than extrasolar planets. And just because they're more luminous, they're hotter bodies, so they're easier to detect.
So I was like kind of interested in the fact that one of the thrusts of his research is the study of clouds in the atmospheres of brown dwarfs, which, you know, was a concept that I found kind of counterintuitive, you know, because I always thought of them as stars. So the idea that they have clouds that you can look at.
Yeah, just like how Jupiter has.
Exactly right. You know? So
right.
I found that kind of an interesting thing. I think I had to ask him a question about that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a little bit surprising that such a thing was possible.
Yeah, and that they're so hot that they actually have metal.
Yeah, exactly.
Clouds.
Yeah, exactly. They've got metal in the clouds. I mean, that was another thing that I was also very, you know, surprised by. I mean, was there anything else about the interview that kind of stood out for you guys?
Well, for me, I think I really liked when he talked about how there's a difference in terms of education back home in his country of China and here, and how the differences actually, like the diversity basically brings creativity.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
Like, you know, innovation, I guess, also in a way, because, you know, even it's the same for me, like my education back home in India, it's very theoretical. It's very much, you know, facts are told to you, you're not doing anything hands-on or anything unless it's like you're in a lab
mm-hmm.
in your high school.
Mm-hmm.
So you never had a chance to make volcanoes and stuff like that, you know, from household stuff or anything like that. And
mm-hmm.
but here it's completely different. So when you bring people from such varied educational background, you bring in people with, you know, theoretical ideas and practical, and you throw that mix together and you
mm-hmm.
get awesome science.
Yeah, you get creativity, which is interesting. The difference between sort of students in China and students over here, whereas, you know, in China maybe the kind of technical ability is very high, but the creative side is much not as prevalent, whereas
yeah.
over here he said it was kind of the other way around, which I also kind of found kind of interesting as well.
That's what I mean when I say, you know, back home it's more theoretical.
Yeah,
it's like there's a lot of technical, like our math is really advanced compared to what's being taught here in schools, but on the flip side we don't get to, you know, make projects or
mm-hmm.
You know, inquire in one direction because that's what you like it. So most of the people who are really into something. For example, when I was young and I wanted to learn more about space, all my parents would do was buy me books because that wasn't something that was taught in schools. Mm-hmm. We didn't have space. Like, we didn't even study about the nine planets. Oh, I'm too old. Yes. in school. So it's that area, South Asia, it's very common to be technically very skilled, but not be as creative.
Mm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I also appreciated this discussion on how anyone can get involved, just using like all the different citizen science programs like Zooniverse. Anyone can, with any background, can just start looking at this data and maybe find something that the scientists missed. And they could potentially discover something.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration. This episode was produced by Parshni Patel and John Kissy and featured an interview by host John Kissy. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts John Kissy, Parshni Patel, and Dana Beaton. Our editors were Dana Beaton, Parshni Patel, and John Kissy, and I'm John Kissy. Our theme music was Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation, find out more about Western Worlds, and listen to past episodes by visiting our website at www.cpsx.uwo.ca/Western Worlds, or checking out iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. On behalf of the entire Western Worlds team, thank you for spending this time with us. We hope you'll return in the future for another episode of Western Worlds.